Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks. Awesome. Well, welcome back, everyone, to Sharkpedia.
We have an awesome new guest this week. I'm very excited.
I am very, very, very excited. Today, we're so excited to have Dr. Michelle Heupel on the podcast. Dr. Heupel. I usually don't mess up this much at the beginning. I am a little nervous right now because I am extremely, extremely excited for this interview. I don't know if I said this or mentioned this in any of my emails that when we were coordinating with you, but your paper, this paper we're interviewing you on today, is the basis of one of my PhD chapters. And so I have been so excited to talk to you and pick your brain and maybe selfishly ask you some questions about my own research.
No problem. Don't stress. It's just a casual chat.
It's really fun doing this podcast because we get to interview people who we wouldn't normally get to have one-on-one chats with. So sometimes when it's someone that we're like a little bit starstruck about, we get really nervous beforehand.
Yeah, it's I know how you feel. I remember when I met John Stevens for the first time, who is in Australia, you know, was not Mr. Shark, but I mean, he was one of the acolytes in the field, and I was just like, oh my gosh. So yeah, it's funny.
It's interesting to start getting on that the other side of that, I'm sure, too.
It's weird.
Some people have started doing that to Imani and I. They're like, how do you get where you are? And I was like, what are you talking about? Where am I? What am I doing?
Don't worry. That doesn't go away. people come to say that to me, and I'm like, I'm still just making it up as I go along, guys, you know? So.
Amazing. Well, before we start getting into your awesome article, could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do in the shark industry?
Yep. So I'm Michelle Heupel. I am a shark researcher. I did my PhD at the University of Queensland in Australia. I'm originally American. I did my undergrad studies in Colorado. And then I've worked across a range of different organizations. I spent 10 years at Moat Marine Lab in Sarasota, Florida, then moved back to Australia and have worked at the Australian Institute of Marine Science and James Cook University. All of that time really focusing on understanding shark ecology and particularly movement ecology and how that relates to management and conservation.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
So today, the article that we're going to be talking about is Shark Nursery Areas, Concepts, Definitions, Characterization, and Assumptions. And the summary that we have for you is, shark nursery habitats are critical areas that sharks rely on for their early life stages. However, the criteria for defining these shark nursery grounds has been inconsistent through history. These inconsistencies can make management strategies more difficult, as well as some definitions could imply that all coastal areas are nursery habitats and other definitions are insufficient. In this study, Heupel et al. Propose a new definition for shark nursery habitats that are more accurately pinpoint the essential fish habitat. And that definition is 1, sharks are more commonly encountered in this area than other areas. 2, sharks have a tendency to remain or return for extended periods. And 3, the area or habitat is repeatedly used across different years of their life. These criteria make a definition of shark nursery areas more compatible with those of other aquatic species as well. Improving the definition of this concept will provide more valuable information for fisheries managers and shark biologists.
Yeah, thanks. So I think to start us off, one of my first questions for you, Dr. Heupel, is could you explain why creating this criteria to define nursery habitats for sharks was so necessary within shark science?
Yeah, this started off, honestly, with some conversations with people saying, oh, you know, we caught three baby black tips or three baby bull sharks, you know, here, and that must make it a nursery area. And it started the question in my mind about how do we actually define that? And if we need to protect nursery areas to try and support sustainable shark populations, then it can't just be everywhere that newborn or juvenile sharks occur, because the blacktip shark, which I was studying at the time, we know they migrate. So at what point, you know, where is the nursery if we know they're moving from, say, central Florida to southern Florida seasonally? That means that we have to designate the entire state of Florida as a shark nursery area. That's not effective. We can't realistically do that. So it started driving questions about how would we actually set some meaningful boundaries around this that managers could use and say, okay, this is a designated area that we could effectively protect. And that started then a number of conversations about, well, what would the criteria be? How would we actually define this and make it usable and applicable in a management sense?
Excellent.
Our next question was going to be, why is it important to identify nursery habitats for sharks? I don't know if you have anything that you want to expand on from what you were previously just saying for that question.
Yeah, I will. I think, and this will tie into, I'm going to ramble now. This will tie into your questions around essential fish habitat. And that is to say that nursery areas are areas that species use, you know, for a survival mechanism, right? And so understanding where the nursery areas are is really critical to our understanding of the population dynamics and what that might mean for the population going forward. So it's not, it's a management piece, but it's also understanding the ecology of the species and what they require to thrive and survive.
Awesome. And yeah, those definitions have changed a lot, it sounds like, which we will get into here in a moment. But in the beginning of your article, you also mentioned that there's a current mandate by NOAA to incorporate essential fish habitat in all fisheries management plans. And I wanted to touch base on that really quick because some of our listeners might not know the terms essential fish habitat. They might not even know what NOAA is. So maybe who is NOAA and what is essential fish habitat and how does nursery habitats fit into that?
NOAA is the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and they encompass the National Marine Fisheries Service, who manages the fisheries for the country. And they have, you know, the responsibility of managing and coordinating what's happening with species that are commercially and recreationally fished in the U.S. Essential fish habitat is a concept where NIMFS, to shorten that, is looking at the connections between fish populations and their habitats and their environment. So again, nursery areas are key areas that species are relying on for survival. If those habitats are degraded, then it has impacts on the ability for those species to reproduce and survive. So it's not just about how many fish we catch, but also do those fish have healthy habitats in order to survive in. The paper talks about that being implemented. I have to point out that paper was written 15 years ago now. so I'm assuming that has all happened in the meantime and through a range of different mechanisms. We looked at this for sharks in part because it's pretty well known. It was at the time pretty well known for a lot of the fish species, particularly the commercially important species, where we understand their life cycles and their life histories very well. It was less well defined for sharks, and that was another reason that we were linking into that policy at that time.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned it's been however many years, because for me, I just recently learned about this paper. I started my PhD a few years ago. And it has become the basis of one of my chapters for my PhD. And it's since I have read this, I have consistently heard people reference this specific paper pretty much any time somebody discusses a shark nursery habitat. They're like, well, do you know the criteria as defined by this paper? So it seems very widely accepted through the shark community. And since you've published this paper, a lot of people have actually done what I am now doing, which is take your criteria and try to apply it to see whether or not an area actually does fulfill the criteria to be a nursery ground. And then hopefully might have increased protections on those areas if they are essential fish habitat for that species.
That's amazing. And that's exactly what we were hoping to achieve with this paper, was to set some guidelines that people could pick up and consistently apply, so that when we do get the results from those things, then it's easy and it's clear to go, you know, and talk to fisheries managers or conservation, you know, managers or organizations and say, we've done the work, we can actually define this area, we have the evidence for it. You know, here's a space that could be protected in order to help this species. So that's exactly what we were hoping would be achieved when we worked on this.
Yeah, I would say mission accomplished.
it's exciting that it worked. You know, it's exciting to hear that it's been so widely accepted and picked up. That's, we didn't know whether that was going to work at the time. So it's amazing how well it's gone.
Yeah, best case scenario.
For our listeners who don't really understand how funding and things work, especially when you're able to define something as important as a nursery, is that something that NOAA provides funding for, to be able to fill this mandate that they currently have active?
I don't have an answer to that question. I'm not sure. This is something that, you know, I worked on this with my co-authors, with Colin Simfendorfer and John Carlson, who was working at NIMS, National Marine Fisheries Service, at the time. And we did it, I guess, kind of on the side of other things that we were already doing, because it was such an important question for us. And my research area, when this is when I was at Moat Marine Lab, my research focus at the time was on black tip shark nurseries and how dependent they were on nurseries and how they use that space. So it really aligned with my research questions and what I was thinking about. So we just incorporated it into work we were already doing, rather than going and seeking specific funding to support us to do this.
And were you studying, you said black nose sharks, was that on the East Coast or black tips?
It was black tips on the West Coast, so in just south of Tampa Bay.
Okay, great. Florida. Nice. Okay, so I want to touch on some of the history that you go over in your paper, because shark nursery concepts, it wasn't the first, you know, idea to define this in your paper in 2007. There is a history of people bringing these concepts up that I want to go over quickly. For our listeners, this started in 1967 with a publication from Springer, who defined shark nursery habitats are essentially shallow water habitats where they remain before they are sexually mature or forced out by seasonal temperature changes. So that was in 67. And then in 1978, the author Bass introduced the concept of primary and secondary nursery areas, where primary nursery areas are where the young are pupped and secondary nursery areas are for larger juveniles. And then in 1990, Brandstetter defined nursery grounds as areas that are protected by predators specifically, particularly adults. And then Castro and another publication by Simpenforder and Millward, both of those publications in 1993, refer to communal nursery areas where several species utilize the same habitat for their young. So generally speaking, why do these definitions that have been brought up historically, why are they not adequate? And we can also like take that definition by definition if you'd like.
Look, I think those definitions are all adequate in their own ways. And it's important to remember that we had a particular goal in mind in being able to define areas rather than describe the concept, which is where Stuart Springer started. You know, John Bass expanded on that. And as we wrote this paper, we actually reached out to John and asked his opinion, because we were disagreeing with him on the secondary nursery areas. And we talked it through with him and said, okay, well, what do you think about this? We don't, you know, we're trying to develop these criteria. We're not seeing the secondary nursery area thing, and it confuses the literature. So he actually gave us his blessing to to talk about, you know, whether secondary nurseries really are a thing. The work that Steve Branstetter did was defining, you know, what some of the benefits are in the use of nursery areas. So those all factored in. And then the Castro work and the Simpfendorfer and Millward, that's an interesting thing, and it's something that I hadn't really worked on until we got to when I came back to Australia and started working in a place called Cleveland Bay, where we have a range of different shark species that are all using a confined area. And this is where Simpfendorfer was talking about when he talked about his communal nursery areas, is we had a lot of juveniles that were in there and sharing space. And interestingly, if the adults are in, you know, distributed in different places than the neonates or the newborns, then if they're all sharing a space and they can do that effectively, then they're all protected from the adults of the other species who are not using those areas. So it creates sort of a group benefit by them sharing those spaces. So we kind of tried to pull in all of those different elements and use them to inform how we might create the criteria and a working definition with the intent of applying for management rather than a sort of a totally theoretical construct, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I found it interesting reading these previous definitions because in my head, it seems like they all make sense for what a nursery ground is, but it doesn't seem like they'd be that applicable for if you actually wanted to do something about it. Like, they're all just like a description of the thing rather than an actual tangible thing that you can then take and, you know, manage the area with.
Yep, that's it exactly. And that's the difference. So they're all, like I said, they're all valid for their reasons, but they didn't quite go that next step where you could use them to say, is this a nursery or not?
Yeah. So you also mentioned that not all nursery grounds are pupping grounds. Can you just touch on that a little bit? Because I will say, as someone who's does not do this kind of research, I definitely thought that all nursery grounds were pupping grounds.
Well, yeah, it's... Okay, where do I start? I guess the thing is that you don't often catch pregnant females in nursery areas. And so there are questions about, you know, do the females come in and pup in an area and then leave? And that's where the newborns live. Or are they potentially pupped somewhere near that area and then the newborns swim into the nursery? So it's entirely possible that the pupping happens actually outside what we might designate as a nursery, and the young are swimming into that area as opposed to being, you know, deposited there, I guess, by the mother. So we wanted to make that distinction that there are some areas where people have reported that they see animals pupping, females pupping, but the young don't stay there. So they must be going somewhere else. And so that means that's not the nursery.
Yeah, that does make sense. And this is, for me personally, who does do this for part of my day-to-day, I studied seven-gill sharks in San Francisco Bay. And the evidence here is demonstrating that pregnant females are coming in. There are records of fishermen getting pregnant females like in this like shallow habitat of San Francisco Bay, which is super cool and very different from other species that might, as you said, give birth or pup their pups off in open ocean, and then those pups then swim into that habitat that they need to be in. Another really important thing that I think you bring up is that not all shark species will have nursery areas. So I wondered if we could talk about, why do we think this is? What are the trade-offs between having a nursery ground versus not having a nursery ground?
Yeah, I think, so we talk about nursery areas as being a trait, and it's a life history trait. So I think it depends, the simplest way to say it is whether they need one or not. There are some species that are really, really productive. They have a lot of babies, and they don't necessarily, if some of them die because they can't feed themselves or they are lost to predators, there's enough of their siblings to survive to keep the population going. So they may not need to rely on a nursery as a protective area for their survival. The other end of the spectrum, we could have animals that are born at such a large size that they have very few predators. And again, they might not need the shelter of a nursery area. So it depends on their life history, you know, where they live, what other species are around that area, the size of their pups, the productivity, you know, the number of pups that they have. These are all factors that would drive the survival rate of those animals. So my view of it is that it's whether they need that to help ensure the survival of their young or not is part of why they may or may not use a nursery. There are open ocean species that, you know, what would the nursery be? They're, you know, if they're born out offshore in deep water, you know, they're unlikely to swim, you know, to a coastal area to use a shallow habitat. So there are some species that they have a different niche, and they're using different areas, to survive. And
no, that was great. And this is where I'm going to get selfish and ask and just like share specifically about my study species. Seven-gill sharks you can find around the world. There's populations in South America, in the Northeastern Pacific, which is a population I study on the western coastline of the United States. There's also a population in New Zealand and Southern Australia and South Africa. And these populations don't mix. But what I'm finding, or what scientists have found about this species, is that there are very different trade-offs between populations. In South Africa, they haven't identified any pupping or nursery grounds for seven-gill sharks and have somewhat concluded, or at least theorized, that maybe they just are distributing their pups along their range. Whereas in South America, seven-gills are pupping, I don't know about pupping, but their nursery ground has been identified in a specific bay, but only during the summer months. And then the rest of the time of the year, they don't know where they are. Whereas in San Francisco Bay, we're finding that juveniles are there present for years, all year round. Yeah. And they're also kind of weird because these are big apex predator sharks, but they're averaging 80 pups per litter, which is really impressive for an apex predator. Usually it's like 1 to 2 pups for a white shark or sand tiger. So they're just like breaking a lot of assumptions, I feel like, in my mind. They really break a lot of rules. And so, yeah. So my whole dissertation, I've been like, why is this species demonstrating like every possible trade-off? You know, and why does that change in different areas of the world? So this is just a question I'm really interested in. And I think about a lot. Why are seven-gill sharks on the Northeastern Pacific migrating potentially really long distances and all coming to this one location that's also very shallow and might be at risk for elimination with climate change? It averages 15 feet, and that's not going to withstand warming temperatures in the long run. So I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but I just wanted to share it because that's what I think about all the time.
Yeah. So my answer is going to be a bit of a wandering explanation of some of my experience and my thoughts of working on sharks for 25 years in different places. And I'll pull a few examples. My ultimate answer is, they're incredibly well adapted to their environment, to their, you know, the circumstances where they are, and they will adjust in order to, you know, to survive in those circumstances. The reason that I say that is, we see different things like this. You know, dusky sharks is another good example. They have nursery areas inshore in the U.S. The young dusky sharks in Australia are often found offshore. See, it's the complete opposite pattern. What the rationale, you know, what the reasoning for that is, I don't know, but I suspect there is some, they have evolved that way because there was some benefit or threat in one situation or the other that they've learned through the generations to survive by using the habitat in these different ways to suit the environment that they're in. The other reason, you know, is watching, I've spent, I don't know how many years studying reef sharks. And reefs are, you know, have different shapes and different formations and different you know, levels. So when you look at reef sharks, who are very habitat and site attached, we'll actually find that reef sharks do slightly different things on slightly different reef platforms. They're adjusting to the conditions where they are. Even within, you know, the Great Barrier Reef, we'll find different species, the same species doing slightly different things based on the habitat that they're in. So I think they're just fine-tuning themselves to meet their needs where they are.
That is so cool. To me, that's so cool. And I feel like people don't give sharks enough credit. Like, they are, we see the same species and they're adapting to their environment. In which case, you could almost argue, like, for management purposes, if you're going to manage an area, you have to study those animals in that area. You can't apply what you've learned somewhere else to that area because it might not be accurate in that area.
It's hard, yeah. I mean, and the scale of that question is where it gets sticky, because, you know, they might do similar things in a region, but to assume that, you know, sharks in the Atlantic are doing the same as the same, you know, same species in the Pacific is doing the same thing, I think is, you know, that's a blanket statement. There are some species that are open ocean species that are probably doing, potentially doing similar things given, you know, their habitats, but there are a lot of species that I think we have to think about how much we try to apply information from one area and make assumptions about another.
Yeah, I think that's really important to remember too.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
I think this kind of all leads into our next question that we had, which is that there's this assumption that nursery areas will provide ample resources for juvenile sharks, but this has been shown to not really be true. And in addition to that, there's this, in this trade-off of having a nursery habitat, you're also running the risk of having more competitors for the resources in that area. Can you just talk about a little bit those two trade-offs kind of together and the sort of interactions that might be occurring in these nursery areas?
Yeah, these are things that are really hard to tease out. And we've made some assumptions that you would use a nursery area because it creates benefit. And the two major things that we know young sharks need are food and to hide from predators or to avoid predators. And so I think those are two reasonable assumptions. Whether that's going to apply everywhere is, again, it's this plasticity thing, you know, these differences in different areas, and the trade-offs may outweigh each other. So it might be that it's not a particularly productive area, so there isn't a lot of prey around, but the predation risk outside that area is so high that it makes it worthwhile to stay in a low prey area, because the risk is higher outside that area. So I think, again, it's circumstantial, and it depends on these trade-offs. Ideally, you have an area that provides both of those things and promotes survival, but that's obviously not always the case. Competition is an interesting question as well. I mean, when we looked at the communal nursery here in Australia, one of the questions we wanted to ask was, are these species competing with each other, and what does that mean for their survival in an area? And what we found was that they tended to actually have niches, and they were using slightly different areas. Particularly, species that had similar diets tended to distribute themselves, separate themselves a little bit in the area, where species that didn't have dietary overlap are more likely to share space. So there are ways that they can actually work in a community. They're still competing probably for space, and they're competing in some instances for prey, but those subtle changes or differences in their distribution can help manage that.
Very complex is what I got out of this paper, to be honest. It's just that this is all extremely complex from like every angle that you could attack it.
It is. And the more you dig into it and the more you think about it, the more complicated it gets. And so trying to find some base things that we can work on to try and understand. And then, you know, we chipped away at it 15 years ago. Megan's chipping away at it more. You know, people, we just need to keep building our knowledge and trying to understand how this applies, and keeping in mind that it'll be different in different places. It'll be different for different species, but it's that collective knowledge that hopefully helps us get to a point where we can understand and do more to make sure that these species are protected and managed.
Yes. And you mentioned also that something that I hadn't thought about before was that you mentioned that schooling behavior in juveniles can occur, and that predation could affect movement patterns and habitat use from predation. And could you expand on this? I don't know if seven-gill sharks school in this region. They've been noted to school in other populations around the world. But we can't see them very well in San Francisco Bay, because San Francisco Bay, for those that don't know, is like a bay of chocolate milk. You can't see through it. So we can't necessarily. That's how I describe it. I'm like, you can't.
You're not see wrong. That's what it looks like.
If I attach a camera to a shark, I will just get a very long video of an animal swimming through chocolate milk. That's what it will look like. So anyway, back to my question. How does predation impact movement patterns and habitat use?
So this is really based, my answer to this is based on the work that I did in Terracea Bay, which is near Tampa Bay in Florida. And it was looking at black tip sharks and how they use that space. Terracea Bay, like San Francisco Bay, really turbid. You can't see your hand in front of your face when you get in the water. So we used passive acoustic tracking. So we put transmitters on sharks, and we had listening stations around the bay that we could use to see where the sharks were moving, how far they were moving, where they spent time. And what we found was two things. One is that they tended to aggregate. All the animals that we tagged were in a group in a reasonably confined area during the day, and they moved a bit further afield at night. The other thing we learned is that they started to use more and more space as they got older. So we would catch them early in the summer, sort of May, June, and they would use a really small, concentrated area of the bay. And then by the time we got to August, they were using sort of half of the bay. By the time we got to September, October, they were using the whole of the bay and starting to move out into Tampa Bay as they got ready to migrate. So we have some evidence from them that they're aggregating, and possibly that's a defense mechanism. So if they're in a group, there's a bit of safety in numbers kind of thing happening, and that possibly they're moving a little bit more at night when they maybe felt safer because of conditions in the area or potential patterns of when the predators were around. I'm not sure. Again, we can't see in there. We don't know exactly what's going on, but we could tell that they were spending a lot of time together early in their lives. Right after they were born, they didn't move much away from each other, even at night. They were really collectively using a particular area. The question is that due to predator avoidance and again, safety in numbers, or was there a lot of prey there, high prey density, and it was just a good place for them to feed? I don't know. We couldn't really tease those two things apart, but I suspect that predator avoidance was a big part of it. And I say that because one of the days we were fishing in the area to catch animals to tag, And we heard a noise and we looked over to see a big hammerhead fin come peeling up out of the water. And we were fishing. There was a sailboat moored not far away from where we were. And all of a sudden we could see right at the surface this little newborn black dip going shooting towards this sailboat. And the hammerhead actually having to slow down because it would have clipped its fin on the sailboat. So this little shark was, you know, running under this sailboat to get away from this predator. So we know that they were being, they were actively being chased in that area during those times. And the tracking data also showed two of our transmitters were actually moving much farther and much faster than any of those little sharks could have been swimming. So we presume that a hammerhead or something else came in and ate and both of those animals, which is why we saw this very strange pattern in their movement. So the predation risk is real in those areas, and that might be part of what they're trying to avoid.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Also, I just feel like we don't credit sharks enough for like how good they are at surviving. I mean, obviously some of those guys got chomped on, but they're older than trees, everybody. Sharks are smart. They know how to survive.
Yep. Yep. They learn and they've evolved.
So before we get into what your proposed definition is, which was basically the key takeaway of this paper, you also mentioned that primary and secondary nursery habitats can be really difficult to define because they can theoretically overlap. Yep. Can you talk about the difference between them and why they might overlap and why that's kind of led into this idea that it's hard to separate them?
Yeah. So we talked about this a little bit, that John Bass talked about, you know, the area where the animals were pupped as a primary nursery area, and then where some of the older juveniles could be as a secondary nursery area. One of the things that I found in Teresia was that we had animals that used the bay the year they were born, but we also had animals that came back a year later and used the bay again. And 2 years later, you know, after that, the tags were no longer functional. But then the question is, well, we know it's a primary nursery area because we know we've got newborn animals in there, but does having 1 year olds in there then make it a secondary nursery? And it gets confusing. And we just thought calling it a nursery is a much cleaner way to do that. And not try and split things apart. The other element to that is that black tip sharks and dusky sharks and some of the other species migrate. So they leave the primary nursery in the winter when the water temperatures drop. Does that then make their winter habitat a secondary nursery? And so it just started getting really, the more we tried to define things, the more confusing it got. And we just thought it's actually just simpler if we say, we're not going to talk about secondary nursery areas and just focus on what John would have called a primary nursery.
Yeah, I feel like trying to define those two things does make sense to me, especially if they are delineated really clearly in a species. But for consistency, I like that that wasn't included in the proposed definition.
And, in my mind, if there's a secondary nursery, then it should be a place where you only find, you know, the older juveniles, and the newborns are in a separate place. So again, it's that, and if that exists, that's great. Then that can be a secondary nursery area. But I think teasing those things apart is where it needs to land, for me anyway.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And this leads to the proposed definition that you and your co-authors came up with. Which I'll just state here for our listeners. There's three criteria, and the first proposed criteria is as follows. Sharks are more commonly encountered in the area than other areas, i.e. the density in that area is greater than the mean density over all areas. Do you want to touch on that at all before we move on from that first point?
Yeah, so this is where we're looking for places where newborn or young sharks are concentrated. So there are some places, again, particularly black tip sharks in Florida, there are bays that you can go into and you'll find a lot of young black-tipped sharks. If you go out on the beaches, sometimes you'll see them if they're moving out there, but they're not consistently there. So we were looking for those areas where we could find a lot of them.
Awesome. So, and also basically it sounds like just because you find juveniles there does not mean it's a nursery ground. It has to be in a higher concentration. Okay. And then the second criteria is that sharks have a tendency to remain or return for extended periods, weeks or months, i.e. they have site fidelity is greater than the mean site fidelity for all areas. Could you touch on that as well?
Again, that's about making sure that it's an area where they're consistently spending time. So an example from Terracea is that towards the end of the summer, we would have animals that would move out into Tampa Bay and then come back into Terracea Bay, but they were only really out in Tampa Bay for really short periods of time. And then they would come back into Terracea, which we classified as a nursery. We were trying to differentiate that just because they went out and started exploring into those new areas before they migrated. That doesn't make that area a nursery. And likewise, the time when they're swimming from Central Florida down to Southern Florida doesn't make every area that they swam through a nursery because they didn't really spend any significant amount of time there. We're looking for those places where we have a lot of animals and they're consistently there, because that helps define a place where you can put in protection and do that in a meaningful way for a large number of animals over that are using that area over a period of time.
Awesome. And then the last and third criteria that your paper demonstrated was that the area or habitat is repeatedly used across years, whereas others are not.
And again, this is about if we're going to – the intention of – one of the intentions of this paper was to give managers a way to, for lack of a better term, draw a box on a map and say we're going to protect this area. If that area is moving around all the time – it's really difficult to put a management takes a long time to get, you know, enacted and get rolling. So we wanted something where we knew that, yes, these animals are reliably using this area so that it's worth going through the management process to say this is an area that we're going to designate as a protected area. If it's moving around, that's not impossible to deal with from a management perspective, but it's much more difficult and complicated to do. So we thought if we could define it down into something that was clear and easy to manage, that was the best place for us to land.
I have a question about this specific criterion. Is there a certain amount of times that repeatedly means, or is it just like vibes?
You know, we didn't put any parameters on that. And I guess, you know, 15 years ago, we weren't thinking about climate change the way we are now. Repeatedly, I think at that point we were thinking, you know, is something fairly consistent. And if the habitat didn't change, then there wouldn't be any reason to think that those animals wouldn't keep returning to those areas. We have evidence of natal filipatry where animals come back to the place where they were born to give birth to their young. So I think we assumed repeated meant, you know, this is a pattern for the population. This is something that they've evolved to do. And one of the reasons that we wanted this kind of designation is if it is a repeatedly used place and it's a habitat that these animals have been evolved to use, if we degrade it or we lose it, then that has implications, you know, generational implications for the population. 15 years later, you know, thinking about climate change and how some of these areas are going to change temperature-wise and sea level-wise, I'm not sure how that will affect these areas where these animals have relied on for the survival of their populations. It's going to get interesting, I guess.
Oh, yeah, it's going to get really interesting.
Real interesting, real fast.
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody has the answers to those questions. And I'm disappointed, and yeah, I wish we weren't having to answer them, but we will.
Yeah, absolutely.
So currently available technique, there's a bunch of different available techniques that can be used to determine if an area meets the above criteria. For example, scientific surveys can be designed to quantify the number of sharks in all possible regions, both within and between years, assuming the juvenile habitats are surveyed simultaneously, which is criteria 1 and 3. Can you expand on this? And specifically, what do you mean by assuming that juvenile habitats are surveyed continuously?
So this is where we were thinking about how do you test this? So what methods would you use? And one of the major methods that we use, particularly in these inshore areas, is either rod and reel fishing or gill net fishing to try and understand what the abundance is in catch per unit effort. So that was thinking about a sampling technique where you went to multiple places in the same years in similar times. So for example, working in Tampa in 3 sites in Tampa Bay in, you know, May, June, July, August, so that you could see how what the patterns were through time. So did you find more animals in one area than another? Was that consistent across those months? And then if you did that across years, then you have a reliable data set where you could say, okay, area 1, you know, sometimes has some animals in it, some young animals in it. Area 2, consistently every time we go there, you know, through the summer, we catch a lot of young animals. Area 3, we don't catch any. So from that, we could say, well, area 1, there's maybe some questions. Area 2, we would have some comfort that that's a nursery area. Area 3, we would rule out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Part of what I have been stuck on thinking about my own work is that 7-gill sharks are really widely distributed across their range, from our populations from Alaska to Mexico. And trying to demonstrate that San Francisco Bay is a specific habitat that's different from other habitats has been a little tricky, because I can fish for them with hook and line in San Francisco Bay, but the access for me to do that outside of San Francisco Bay and open ocean is a lot more difficult. So I've been relying on catch data from Fish and Wildlife, but their catch effort is very different. They use gill nets or trawls, whereas I'm using a rod and reel. Do you think those techniques can be compared if just the simple absence of juvenile sharks showing up at all in catch data? Do you think that could be enough?
Yeah, I'd have to. I mean, I think you've got to use what you can use. And it depends. I'll do the typical scientist answer and I'll say it depends, right? So it depends on how intensively they're sampling those areas. So if they're using a different method to you, gill nets can be more effective than rod and reel if you've got animals that aren't, you know, taking a bait. So it will depend on what tool is being used where. It will depend on how intensively they're sampling in those areas. So I think I don't have a straight answer for you on that one, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, that's okay. It's just something that came to mind as I was reading this. And then, yeah, there's just always more questions.
Yes.
And then for shark residency within a region, which is criterion 2, it can be tested using mark recapture studies, where you capture a shark, you mark them with a tag, you let them go, and then if you catch them again in the same area, that's called mark recapture. You could also do acoustic tracking, stable isotope analysis, or acoustic monitoring. I wondered, what about year-round presence of all size classes over years? Could that fulfill criterion 2 if you don't have a ton of mark recapture, or maybe stable isotope analysis was inconclusive, or you didn't have the funding for acoustic tracking? If you see all age classes present all year round over multiple years, do you think that could also fulfill criterion 2 to demonstrate that shark residency occurs in that region?
Probably. I guess the question that immediately springs to mind is, how do we know that those are the same animals that are relying on that area for their survival? And that's where the mark recapture comes in and is a really useful and cheaper tool to apply, because then if you're catching tagged animals, then you know that animal was consistently there through that time. It's probably the same animals that are there that are hanging around, but you can't know that. You can't know what you don't know, I guess.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
And then this is kind of our last question before our favorite question, since we're coming up on an hour. I was wondering how you think that improving this definition, you know, however many years ago, has improved management proposals and practices, if at all.
That's a great question, and probably one to put to someone in NIMS or one of the management agencies. One application that I know it's been used in was in the Endangered Species Act protection of small-tooth sawfish in the U.S. They use those nursery criteria and the nursery designation to try and create some management to protect small-tooth sawfish, which were critically endangered. So that's one direct application where I know this paper was picked up and used. I've seen in the literature where people have used it to try and test and identify nursery areas, whether that's translated into management or, you know, closure, fishing closures or protections of those areas, I don't know. But hopefully it's created a platform for people to pick up that information and use it in a way that can put some meaningful management and protection in for species. I hope so, but I don't know beyond the sawfish example.
Well, hopefully I will be providing a seven-gill example here in the coming year. That's the goal.
The small-tooth sawfish example is really cool, though.
It is. I didn't know that. It's awesome. So lastly, but definitely not leastly, I don't even know if that's a word. One of our favorite questions that we ask on this podcast is, what is your favorite field story? It can be about anything that's happened in the field. It doesn't have to be about juvenile shark nurseries. Just anytime you're out in the field. We love asking this because people have just had really crazy different experiences in the field that we don't often get to talk about.
I'm really glad that you asked this question. And I'm glad that you asked this question because it's given me pause to go back and think about 25 years as a field biologist. I'm showing my age now. And think about the good times that I had in the field and the amazing things that I got to see. You know, we caught a really young tiger shark years ago, would only been, you know, a meter long, a yard long. Just the most beautiful stripy little, you know, baby shark, and I've never seen another one. So that was, you know, there are moments like that or days when the weather was amazing and, you know, you're on the boat with people who have become lifelong friends from having worked in the field together and spent so much time on boats. But probably for me, the most one of the most important and memorable days in the field was when I convinced my parents to be volunteers on one of my field trips. And my parents are not scientists. They knew I'd explain to them what I do for a living, but I took them out on the boat and took them shark fishing, and they got to catch a shark and see a shark up close and understand and see me, you know, at work and do what I do. And that was just, it was a really, really special day for me, for them to get to experience the things that I've been telling them all about and see these amazing animals for themselves up close. So that was probably one of my top days in the field ever.
Oh, I love that.
I got to do that with my parents too, with both my moms. They got to each come out separately, and one of them got to touch a bull shark and the other one got to touch a nurse shark. And I didn't realize how bad I was at explaining what I do in the field to them until they came out. And at the end of the day, they were like, wow, I did not understand what you were doing.
Yeah, and it's that magic, and I've seen it with students as well. It's that magic moment when people get to see these animals for the first time and be so close to them. It was the combination of them understanding what my life is, but also that, you know, wow, there's a shark. This is cool.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely like the magical part of shark science is
100%. So last question. That's not an interview question. But for our people who were listening to this and find your work really interesting, is there a place that they can follow your work? I don't know if you're on social media because Twitter died, but is there a way for people to follow you aside from just looking out for your published papers?
I am on social media. I'm terrible at social media, to be honest. I'm not great at it. I'm on ResearchGate. I'm on, you know, a bunch of, you know, Google Scholar has, you know, papers on there. I, as you probably know, have moved out of shark research now. I'm director of Australia's Integrated Marine Observing System. So I'm working on papers with some colleagues who are generous enough to keep including me on things, but I'm not doing my own shark research anymore. So that's kind of slowed down the stream of information that's coming from me into the field. Doesn't mean I'm not interested. It just means I'm busy in the new job.
That makes sense. But I'm definitely going to be following your work. I'm also going to be following up with you as my work continues. Thank you so much for being here today and talking about shark nurseries. This was so awesome.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk sharks again. One of my favorite things.
Awesome. All right, until next time.
Swim you later.